Welcome to The Lion's Den, a brand new podcast presented to you by The Bluebird, your source for all things University of Cambridge sport. On our first episode, our host Nathan Johns speaks to Tom Ransley, an Olympic rower, and Hughes Hall Allen.
Okay, so I'm joined now by Tom Ransley. Tom is a former GB rower who has medalled countless times at senior level, including a European gold. He's also a double world champion. He won a bronze medal in the men's eight at the 2012 London Olympics and also got one gold in the same boat in 2016 in Rio. 2016 concluded with Tom being awarded an MBE, but arguably more importantly, Tom is a double blue for the University of Cambridge, having rowed in the boat race twice. I'm correct in saying, was it 2008 and 2009 were your 2 years, Tom?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. And remind me again there, what college and what course you were?
I was history and management. I did 1 year of each at Hughes Hall.
Okay. The Hughes Hall rower, that's quite a common there.
Common
trade in the Blues boat. So I guess one place to start, really, having read up about your career and the trajectory, I guess, January 2021, we're sitting here 6 months out from the, or give or take, from the rescheduled Tokyo Olympics. Is there any part of you, any fiber of your body that thinks, you know, it's only 6 months away, maybe I should have stuck at it and kept going and tried to defend that title in Tokyo? Or are you completely happy with the decision to have? For those who are listening who don't know, Tom retired once the decision was made to postpone the Tokyo Games back in March 2020.
Yeah, no, in a nice, like, short answer, I'm not, don't regret that decision. I just think, I feel pretty happy that I wrung every single last fiber of my being to, like, perform, you know, every year for, you know, 11 and a half years. And if anything, like, probably at first when it was postponed, there was a week where I was like, you know, maybe I can kind of recharge and go again. But actually, I think the postponement meant that I had no doubts whatsoever, because it was just gonna, like, just the guys who are doing it, I feel it's really brutal for them, like the stress to try and do an Olympic year selection wise and then to, like, go straight into all the uncertainty of lockdown, and then still to have that uncertainty, like, it might still not go ahead, or what does it look like? I'm really fortunate I managed to, you know, get the gold in Rio, had a fantastic career, rode with some great people, great coaches. And yeah, I'm going to be an awesome, like, I'd love to watch them do well, but no, I'm done.
At what point following the cancellation, how long did it take you to make that decision?
Anyone who knows me knows I'm pretty useless with timings and dates and stuff, so it's actually quite a difficult question, and especially with, like, all the lockdowns, it kind of all time seems to have blurred into one this year. But I think I probably had the announcement, I was sort of thinking, you know, this was kind of it and I'm going to retire for a while. And then I made the announcement. I had maybe a week where I was thinking, oh, maybe I can try and go again, use the postponement. But then I announced the retirement probably a week after that.
Fair enough. So I read some of the pieces you wrote around the time of the retirement, and a couple of things stood out to me. I mean, for anyone who hasn't read them, Tom has written extensively about the decision to retire, and all these pieces can be found on his website. The one that stood out to me the most, I guess, was the BBC one, where, you know, not to throw your own words back at you, but you just, the decision to go for Tokyo, you described at the time as a compelling dream, a pleasant ego massage, and a fictitious dalliance with the joy of racing. It's not often you hear high-level athletes putting forward that level of brutal honesty about themselves. I mean, I guess what's striking for me there is that that kind of makes it sound like the decision to go for it in the first place before lockdown, looking back at it now, is something you're questioning. Is that fair enough?
I think the when I came off the back of Rio, actually, when you come off the back of any Olympics, it's really tough to know what you're going to do, or I find, and I think a lot of people find that. And it's really like you, anyone who says they know what they're going to do straight after Olympics, I say on the whole, just either, you know, they're not, that's not the full truth, because so much can change. It can be such a massive experience. It can be difficult to say, oh, I'm going to go and, you know, retire or not retire or whatever else. And it's good to make plans, but, you know, you find like the results and stuff can impact that. So before each Olympics, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And I probably thought I was going to retire after every single Olympics. And then I didn't. So then going after Rio, yeah, I remember saying, you know, coming back and then the headlines being Tom's going for Tokyo. And I was like, I don't know if that's, it kind of is true, but also it's just such a massive emotional overload to do an Olympics that you kind of need to recharge a bit. And then gradually, like, you're going, okay, I want to hit Tokyo again. So that's really long-winded. But yeah, essentially, when you're on that, initially you come back, the headlines say Tokyo, but perhaps you're more just, I need to like process stuff first. And you it's such a big like physical ask. It's hitting one world championship at a time, or even one selection race at a time, and then you slowly build yourself up. That's sort of where we're at. But you know, I was 100% committed in that Olympiad as we were getting closer to getting to Tokyo. But obviously, you know, like three Olympics is a stretch. And yeah, physically, mentally, I was pretty much empty.
Yeah, I guess that physical and mental side of things is an interesting discussion, because, you know, again, you've admitted in what you wrote at the time that, you know, only a year out from the Olympics in 2019, you were saying you were pulling a lot of PBs. Yeah. So maybe physically, you probably were there or thereabouts. So how much of the decision was physical and how much of it was actually mental, that you, it just in terms of getting yourself in the right headspace, you didn't think it was possible?
So I did, I was hitting some PBs, but it's still both mental and physical, because you do so much volume of training and so many different tests that, and also the squad can be so competitive that, you know, one single PB isn't necessarily the be all end all. It's making sure you're developing like the right crews, the right psychology of the squad, like being able to produce the right results at the right time, no matter kind of how much volume of training is in your legs and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I was, you know, you're never going to be to be really far away. You know, you're not going to be in the team. So the team is pretty, the squad that is before being selected, you know, it's tight margins. So yeah, like it wasn't a million miles off, but I think I just sort of knew that stuff had sort of, the picture had just gradually changed. And you know, some of the hunger and intensity probably ebbs a bit once you've, you know, been in the team as long as that, or someone, I think actually it might have been Jürgen, sort of said to me, you know, and it sort of fits, like, you don't go for the kit anymore, you know, like, so when you first break in, when you first get a national all-in-one, or, you know, a piece of team kit, that means a lot, and it should do, and that could be J16 or a Junius or an under-23 vest or something, but obviously, you know, like, after many years, even though it's still a massive honour to represent your country, you're not really going for those World Cups or minor races. You're wanting the big one, you know. So all of this sort of gradually moves, and so I just felt like it wasn't going to happen, and I was sort of wanting to move on to other stuff in my life.
So the decision to postpone the Olympics came in March, where were you guys at that point, a couple of months out, training wise? Because I imagine it must have been a relative shock to go in the space of overnight from, I'm imagining at that point, reasonably intensive training to it's over, there's nothing coming, this deadline is gone.
Yeah, so I was training by myself because I've missed out on some of the selection earlier on. And then I was still in touch with a lot of the guys, and I know they were came with a big shock, I guess. But well, Ash did it, like, again, he's trying to put your head back into that time space. I think it probably, you know, IOC left it really late to make that decision. So probably by the time the decision actually had come, you realize that it wasn't really viable, given what we knew about the coronavirus. But obviously, these things were happening a lot quicker, understanding what the virus was, how bad it was and stuff. Pretty tough to handle, but I suppose, the whole world was thrown into uncertainty at that point anyway.
Yeah, of course. And in a normal Olympiad, so let's say back in January 2016, 6 months out from a potential Olympics, what stage of your training would you have been at?
So all the winter is all big miles, miles make champions, that kind of stuff. So... quite a big grind, and you're trying to build your aerobic base. So yeah, so I always found the winter was the worst because the days get shorter. You know, it's dark when you get arrived to Caversham to start training. It can be, you know, sort of twilight to going into darkness by the time you get home, and it's cold. And it's, so yeah, and then. January, you normally do an altitude training camp. Sort of Namibia or South Africa, so try and get a bit of heat, which is nice. But again, like, you come off of Christmas, and it was really nice to see your family, because you really only get September off the Worlds, and then Christmas break. South Africa would almost feel especially far away, because you've just had that, like, little break, like, and with the family, and then you're like back into training and stuff. And then you would do some big selection stuff throughout the year. So that's different. Like the US, I think, do one hit and that's be all and end all. Whereas Jürgen used to give you multiple opportunities to try and get, show your class, I guess. April would be a big final selection stuff, and then you might still get some seat racing through the summer. So that's sort of the breakdown. And it's 7 days a week. We get a day off once every 14 days on average, 3 session days, 2 sessions on a Wednesday and a Saturday, a long row on a Sunday. Stuff like that.
Okay, and then I guess to throw it back towards the Cambridge angle, I mean, obviously, that type of lifestyle of just being permanently busy is obviously was something you were used to from your 2 years at Cambridge. I mean, you also had a degree to throw in alongside, you know, racing for Cambridge at Oxford Rower is the be all and end all.
Cambridge, I felt, was fantastic, awesome experience. Really brutal losing the boat race. So I was sandwiched between winning years of 07 and 10, so I didn't really help that much. I'm pretty sure it's common across all, because there's so many great societies and clubs to get involved in and drama and everything else that, you know, you try and just fit it all in and try and squeeze that degree in as well. Writing on the minibus home, and I felt it was sort of a bit unsustainable, really. So I could really only manage it for a couple of years. And then when you get to the national team, the value of like recovery, that's where they really step on. Because, you know, you are full time. So you're able to kind of hone your whole life around getting that sort of boat speed and stuff. Cambridge is like fantastic coach, Rob Baker. He was a Goldie coach at the time, but head coach in the interim as well when we won Henley together. He's the head coach now for CBC. So I improved a huge amount, like got my technique, my rowing technique up and running and stuff.
It's interesting. I guess the interesting part of your CV there with the boat race is that, and you know, I might be generalizing a bit here, but from a non-rower's perspective, from the outside looking in, when you look at BBC coverage and they talk about, you know, who's in the boat, etc., it tends to be that, yeah, for certain, there have been plenty of people who have, you know, was started in the Oxbridge boats and then would have worked their way onto Team GB or whatever after that. But also there's quite a lot of Olympians who come, you know, especially just after an Olympic year. I think that, for example, there was quite a few in both boats after 2016. They come after they get their Olympic medals or not, or just compete and then get in. So I guess, so even though that wasn't necessarily your path, I'm curious as to your insights as to the nature of the boat race outside of Oxbridge in the rowing community, because obviously it's a big deal, you know, in UK society, it's televised by BBC or whoever, but in terms of the rowing community, obviously it must have that pull that a lot of Olympic athletes will come and to try and be part of that, even though they've, you know, they've achieved the pinnacle as it were by being in the Olympics. So obviously the boat race, even in the rowing community outside of Oxbridge, has quite a large significance.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I think, how can I answer it? So many ways. Like, it's got huge coverage. It's a bit of a, you know, there's a huge, like, tradition and notoriety, I suppose. And it's also, like, a weird race, you know, in the Thames, like, all the corners. I mean, it's in Ely this year, but... so I suppose... You know, you want to be a piece of that, have a piece of that tradition, if you can, if you're able to get in and meet the team. So I think it does. Yeah, it has a big appeal. I used to watch it as a kid on TV, so it's probably part of my inspiration for getting involved in the sport. So yeah, it's probably why I wanted to get. I really wanted to win Henley. I really wanted to win the boat race. I really wanted to win the Olympics. Two out of three.
But I guess that's the interesting point there, because obviously it's not, I guess, the most surprising thing in the world that a British kid is sitting at home watching the boat race being inspired, but the fact that rowers from other countries come in after getting the Olympics, I guess that's the interesting thing for me, is that, you know, a university, because at the end of the day it is student competition, that has such the big appeal that it does. I don't know, maybe that's not surprising to somebody who's been on the inside and lived it, but it just seems interesting that so many internationally decorated athletes still, that even though they wouldn't necessarily have grown up in that culture of you know, every spring, what do most British people do? They watch the boat race. They still wanted to come.
I think that's a fair point, and I'd be kind of curious to see what people think about that. I mean, I know there was quite big in the early 2000s, maybe the 90s, that the Germans, you know, almost the German Federation thought it's a good thing. So they endorsed their athletes going there. US is big collegiate rowing. I don't know. Yeah, there's probably like links between Harvard, Yale and Oxford, Cambridge. And then probably just the TV coverage as well. And just because it's been so many years, it just is in the whole, the rowing family and global community of rowers is fairly close knit. So, you know, information will pass along, right? But it's still, it's interesting. I wonder when internationally people started to come across to do it. I don't know.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to try and find out. Take you back. I mean, obviously, so I was a bit young at the time to be watching it, but I looked at I looked at your boat races, and the 2009 one was very dramatic, wasn't it? I mean, if you wanted to do like a kind of a flashback, I don't know, a lockdown style flashback, which is what everyone seems to do when there's no other sport going on. The 2009, I mean, how aware of you at the time, how aware were you of the start, where the cox's hand went up just as the start call came, and that seemed to set you guys back massively? I mean, sitting in the boat, how aware of you of that were you at the time, and did it play on your mind, or was it just pull as hard as you can? I guess just for reference, for anyone who hasn't watched it, I can't remember exactly how close it was, but literally as soon as the flag went down, so to speak, the Cox's Cambridge Cox's hand went up to say that she wasn't ready. And then, but of course, that
I mean, she definitely wouldn't have said it, and I wouldn't. I don't think I'd be able to see her hand from where I sat. So,
okay,
I suspect it was like, and the thing is, like, you're gonna rate. It's like playing to the whistle, right? Like, you're just racing. So even if you like don't have a great start, or she wasn't ready, or you know there was a mistake in the crew or whatever, you're just gonna go until, and maybe you know if there's a recall, that's great, but you know you're never gonna wait for a recall. Do you see what I mean?
Okay, yeah, no, that's interesting. I guess okay, that clears it up a bit. The fact that you couldn't see her hand, so you wouldn't have been that aware. Okay, I guess that clears that up then. Of course, you mentioned that this year's boat race is at Ely. I don't know, where did the Blues boat squad train at Ely during your time?
Yeah, that's so, right. Yeah,
so you're quite familiar with that stretch of water. How does that compare? Fingers crossed, should the boat race still go ahead? How does that compare to the Thames from your perspective?
So I think it's going to be quite an awesome like contrast for hopefully for 1 year. And there's going to be, it's going to be sort of like a massive drag race, you know? And I reckon the footage is going to be incredible as well, because the Fens is so like flat and dramatic. It will just be a really nice contrast. Obviously, there's a huge amount of uniqueness to racing on the Thames and getting those bends right and all your coxing knowledge. And, you know, you do lose some of that going on a straight course. But I think it'd be a pretty interesting spectacle. And there is history of it. So 1944, the men's race was there because of the war years. So it's, you know, it's still got a sort of link to the past in that sense.
Okay. And obviously you're not involved, so you don't necessarily have this insight. But if you were in the position now of, you know, you're training during the winter, three, four months out from the boat race, and then all of a sudden you guys can't train as a squad because of the national lockdown that was announced recently. Do you think it's still possible to do the individual training, and then fingers crossed you get some sort of team training before the race is supposed to go ahead? Or would you think that a lockdown that lasts, you know, at least a month, if not longer, seriously puts this in jeopardy? Because as things stand, as far as I'm aware, the boats can't train together.
Yeah, like again, a bit how I was referring back earlier, like it's just such a tough situation for the athletes. Clearly it's tough, you know, people are losing their lives, so like much worse out there in the community. But yeah, it's trying to cope with that uncertainty, trying to kind of do your training and not focus on the fact that the event that you're training for might not even happen, because obviously that's going to, you know, be really demotivating and tough to get through. But I know that they actually coped, the coaches are adapting. I've interviewed a few of all the coaches and a few of the athletes for Row 360, which magazine I write for. They're kind of really trying to, you know, optimize Zoom and do like spreadsheets and try and just stay in touch with people. And everyone's like adapting, and it's probably going to be the crew that's able to keep the momentum, even though they're training remotely, and also kind of buy into the technical stuff, so that as soon as you get onto the water, you try and get up and running as quickly as possible. So rather than focusing on what you don't have, which is, you know, the usual program, the normal number of hours on the water, you just focus on getting the most out of what you can.
Okay, yeah, obviously, and of course, and obviously we wish them the best of luck, and fingers crossed the boat race does go ahead. You mentioned their Row 360. I guess that was going to be the final thing I asked you about. You know, you said you didn't really know what you were going to do come the retirement decision. You've written a lot for various different national publications, and obviously you mentioned there you're involved at Row 360. So coming into retirement in the COVID world of not a lot going on, how has the first year or so of your journalism career gone?
Not too bad. So I'm a contributing editor for Row 360, and
It's a great team, which is really nice to feel like you're, cause I think everyone misses the team environment. And, you know, rowing such a massive part of your life, it's kind of nice to be able to give back and stay involved and share like some of the stories that are happening. And so I spoke to lots of different people, so that's quite good. And then, I managed to get the Times, the Telegraph and the Guardian, so that's quite cool, get into there. But still, you know, I still don't really know, long term, where I'll go or how it will pan out, but hopefully it'll go well.
any plans in the pipeline to try and get to Tokyo?
So I put that out there, and I think it's going to be probably nigh on impossible to get the accreditation, especially given the coronavirus. That is a really tough one, because that decision will probably be happening behind the scenes kind of right now. And I know, several months ago in 2020, you were thinking, they had to have a vaccine rolled out if they're going to try and keep the Olympics going as normal. But, with the lockdown now and, the way that, things are panning out, that's still pretty uncertain. So in terms of me trying to get into there as a journalist, I can't really imagine you'd get that.
What about the boat race? Has there been any feelers laid out to try and do some media stuff with that? Fingers crossed, should it go ahead?
I'm going to definitely be covering. I mean, I'll be covering all of them for Row 360 wise. I'm really looking forward to it.
That will involve going to Ely, I assume.
Oh, I see what you mean, being there live. I don't know what's like public knowledge yet. So I don't know.
Fair enough. Okay, fair enough. All right, well, that's a good spot to end on. Thank you very much for joining us today, Tom Ransley. And fingers crossed we get to see you at Ely, and we hope when we get to hear from you and we get to watch some rowing. But in the meantime, Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year.
Thank you for listening to The Lion's Den. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow The Bluebird on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram to keep up to date with the world of Cambridge sport.